in an antique city somewhere in Austria or Czechoslovakia, well-meaning townspeople jealously guard the old stones of Europe. They are equally proud of the ruins of old towers, the Catholic cathedral, and the ancient university, which for many centuries has been under the ideological tutelage of the Jesuit Fathers' order. Somewhere on the outskirts, factories and mills are smoking, and there, on the other side of the track, the working people nest. Cloth and sugar constitute the second pride of the townspeople. The workers are not proud of anything. The university is as little accessible to them as cloth and sugar. Picture here, dear listener, an exhibition of an old European city. Variants of street scenes, exposition of the main characters, the beginning of the main intrigue. The action begins to unfold on the street and almost immediately moves to the university. Professor Carl Zange, a dialectical materialist biologist with his bold experiments and even bolder lectures directed against the divine metaphysics of vitalism, clearly compromises the reactionary professors. Despite all the obstacles, the professor manages to gather around him a small group of the most advanced students who enthusiastically follow his scientific experiments. However, the main danger, according to the dean's office, is that penetrating working class neighborhoods in the evenings, Carl Zange speaks in tavernas, popularizing his theories. It is, however, simply impossible to deprive the chair of an unwanted and restless professor, since his name is known far beyond the borders of the country. The fascist Union of Patriarchal Students, led by Prince Ruprecht Karlstein, and the Jesuit order, led by the monk Professor Ignatius Brzezinsk, a vitalist biologist, enter into an alliance. The famous slogan, "The end justifies the means," is being used again. Meanwhile, Professor Zange is tensely awaiting the results of his experiments, which, if it confirms his theory about the heredity of acquired characteristics, should deal a crushing blow to the theories of his opponents. This experiment, in a broad materialist interpretation, has, in addition, enormous sociological significance. Professor Zange enthusiastically studies the object of his successful experiment, the offspring of a black salamander, which changed color due to the environmental influences, yet retained this color when returned to its original conditions. In another corridor of the university, monk Professor Ignatius, successfully repeating Zange's experiment, destroys his own salamanders with hatred. In the castle, the patriarchal friends of Prince Ruprecht Karlstein are amazed at a drastic change that has taken place in him. The patented slacker and wastrel suddenly plunges into science. In his office, full of guns, pipes, rapiers, and portraits of his beloved horses and women, mountains of books, microscopes, and scientific instruments are unexpectedly discovered. Anyone who dares to cross the threshold is mercilessly expelled. The exception is the arrival of a little man, Petiscus, who brings with him a suitcase filled with brand new shiny banknotes. The prince listens to every word of the strange visitor with respectful attention, almost with fear. Petiscus disappears as insinuatingly and silently as he appeared. The prince hides the banknotes in a secret fireproof cabinet. He calls for Ignatius, and upon his arrival in the prince's office near the fireproof cabinet, Karlstein and Ignatius are busy making some complex calculations. An argument flares up, almost turning into a quarrel. However, thanks to mutual compromises, a peace agreement is reached. There is a sensation on the sidelines of the university. Students crowded around an announcement that Ignatius was calling Professor Sange to a scientific debate. In this regard, the faculty is divided into two warring camps. Sange, who appears at the door, is greeted with applause and boos. Almost the entire city gathers for the scientific tournament. Father Ignatius brings down all the fury and poison of his Jesuit dialectic on Sange. Well-meaning citizens and patriotic students enthusiastically greet their leader. But the behavior of the prince, who maintains indifferent calm, seems even more strange. Strange and calm he remains even as Tsange's response, the unexpected declaration of his discovery and the sharp attack against Ignatius, cause stormy scenes. The cries of delight and approval are drowned out by the cries of rage. Silence is established only when Prince Karlstein appears on the podium. Karlstein's speech causes bewilderment and confusion in the ranks of the patriarchal union. Without rejecting the universal significance of Stange's experiment, but also without declaring himself a supporter of materialism, the prince recognizes the professor as a brilliant representative of scientific thought and applauds him. The audience is so puzzled that neither enemies nor friends are able to react to the aristocrat's speech. After the debate, a small part of the professors secretly shake Sange's hand but quickly retreat at the sight of the members of the dean's office. In the university lobby, a lonely prince respectfully greets a passing professor. But later in the evening, late at night, as a matter of fact, Ignatius comes to the prince. One day, in the absence of the professor, Prince Karlstein comes to the house of Sange. The prince explains his visit with a desire to support and facilitate the work of the professor. The prince, after assurances of his readiness to be useful, offers Sange some expensive instruments that he desperately needs. Sange hesitates. The reputation of the fascist prince is not trustworthy. Then the prince, having caught his incredulous gaze, smiling, presents a statement of his categorical withdrawal from the patriarchal union. The professor, amazed by the indisputable proof of loyalty, agrees to the prince's proposal. Karlstein offers his services as an assistant, and they part as friends. Later in the week, the prince and the professor find themselves working in the laboratory. The prince carefully studies the colors of the salamander. As one moon passes, there is a new sensation at the university. Father Ignatius Brzezinski published a statement in which he claims that the notorious change in the color of the salamanders nothing more than daring blackmail, and that all Tsange's objects are painted with a special unknown composition. The alarmed dean's office urgently sends its largest specialists to the Tsange laboratory. The audit arrives at the professor's house at the moment when Tsange is writing a response to the encouraging friendly letters from the workers. Prince Karlstein, continuing to work in the laboratory, cheerfully reassures Sange. Everything will end well. They will not be able to refute your many years of work. This is another meanness of Ignatius. He concludes with a smile that is hard to read. However, the audit establishes the complete justice of the charges brought. The objects of Sange's experiments, which he carried out over many years, all turned out to be tinted with an unknown composition. The office and all the preparations are sealed by the audit. Sange is so shocked that he is unable to answer questions. At dawn the next day, Professor Zange, who turned grey overnight, accompanied by a small hand cart, disappears around the bend of the street. Zange is without a trace. No one knows his whereabouts. The search leads nowhere. In dirty and damp furnished rooms on the opposite outskirts of the city, a strange tenant appears. All his property consists of a heap of cold clothes and a small glass box in which black salamanders are swarming. To maintain the required temperature under the box, a kerosene lamp burns day and night. Professor Zange steadily continues his experiment. The Moscow Academy received information about an unheard-of medieval persecution of a scientist. A report to the Presidium is made by Mikhail Filonov, a former laboratory assistant of Professor Zange. The Presidium of the Academy issues a resolution on Filonov's business trip abroad to search for the missing professor. The cold weather is coming. Things are getting worse for Zange. In order to earn money for kerosene for the lamp and for rent for the room, he goes to work in a laundry, from where, however, he is fired the next day. The owner of the furnished rooms persistently demands payment for the apartment. On the dusty attic window, Zange, close to suicide, finds an old cracked harmonica. At dusk, Zange, returning home, almost falls under the wheels of a carriage rushing past. The smiling faces of Prince Karlstein and Zange's former wife flashes through the carriage windows. Zange steals kerosene from a brothel which the prince operates, but the last drop of the lamp burns out. The wick begins to smoke and finally bristles. Salamanders were born and died. With his head in his hands, a sobbing professor sits near the terrarium. Without looking at the perished brood, his eyes turn towards a rifle that hangs next to the entrance. Upon reaching it with thoughts of finality, Mikhail Filonov suddenly steps through the door. He walks the downbeat biologist over to his own terrarium with a bottle of kerosene in hand. As light moves across the small filter room, a warmth returns. The small salamanders begin to move around. Filonov looks with Zange through the glass at the new offspring. There are clear signs of black coloring. His theory confirmed in the final scene of our play, Professor Karl Zange is sitting on a train to Moscow, where people know how to appreciate his creative ideas.
I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to the Return of the Repressed. Very happy to sit down here with you again. Last episode got heavy. Sometimes when I read Lukács, I get the same feeling as when I read Hegel. It sounds great if I allow it to just flow through me, but I'm not sure what I'm supposed to understand. The first time I finished History in Class Consciousness, I was living in a container in the jungle with an old Chinese shamaness, or witch. They call themselves Niu. Did you know, by the way, that the Neolithic practice of Wu was known during the Chinese Bronze Age, that is 2000 years before Christ, by a character that looks exactly like the Jerusalem cross or the potent cross. Anyways, living with her and reading that book, I was filled with an unmistakable emotion that returned again when I read it during the last episode, which back in those days amplified my first and only ayahuasca experience, eventually leading me further into the jungle, where I would live in solitude for 9 months. I don't mean to say that I have some special insight into the workings of the historical subject-object, I just mean to say that I believe in what I read to you. The other day I was sitting in my sofa, reading Hegel again, watching my partner make dinner and my son play with his toy cars, as you do, and I caught myself thinking that the scene was somehow the manifestation of the proletarian consciousness. All over the world being tied to the same schedule, proles, if they are lucky, are on the way to work as the sun rises, and come home and wait for or make dinner as the sun sets. Looking out, seeing the sun set behind the mountains, I realized also that this experience would now travel around the world, and as it makes a full circle, I would be back here, and everyone who receives a salary would have been part of the same involuntary ritual, making it the most popular ritual on the planet. The individual in me complained, saying, "But do you not see the uniqueness of your own family? The detail that no one else is going to eat the exact same dinner, etc." And I realized that only matters against the backdrop of this universal consciousness. Only there do these novelties appear with the contrast they deserve. The little arbitrary things that are nonetheless my whole world. Now, to create some kind of coherence in this series, I feel in the last episode we got some good grounding in what can be called proletarian science and how it is opposed to what might be called bourgeois science. But we must not remain on this general level, for this demarcation is not sufficient. There are a multitude of members of the bourgeoisie class who take the class stand of the proletariat and vice versa. It is time to weave into the fabric particular names of particular trends, such as Michurin and Weismann. But it is also time to weave in events of our main protagonist, happenings from Lysenko's life that would come to define his struggle. Lysenko would not become famous outside the Soviet Union until 1948, when he held a famous speech at the Lenin Academy of Agricultural Sciences, which is, as is common in the Soviet Union, has a much longer complicated name, as well as an easier abbreviation. Vasknil, if you pronounce it. V-A-S-K, small h, N-I-L. Of which he became the new organizing head, almost a decade after the demarcation line was made apparent at the Darwin conference of the last episode. By then, he was already 50 years old, so it only makes proper sense that we begin to give a biography of the man's life up until this point. Trofim Denisovich Lysenko was born in the autumn of 1898 in a village called Karlovka of some 10,000 people, far outside Poltava in central Ukraine. Which, I don't know actually if they had 10,000 people back then, probably a lot less. It's nonetheless a place I think only famous to Ukrainians, Russians and Swedes, as it is the site of the historical defeat of Carolinian imperialism. Maybe that's why I have such an interesting connection with him. I don't know. His father, Denis Nikanorovich, was a poor but skilled farmer who expanded the family farm manyfold before joining the local collective farm. They later moved to the Moscow region, where Denis headed a team of vegetable growers at one of the many experimental agricultural stations that the Soviets captured after the revolution, which we mentioned in one of, well, in both of the last episodes. This was the Gorky-Leninsky experimental farm, and the father would work there until he was 95 years old, which is admirable for sure. His son would, as we know, also take the path of agriculture. He was not taught to read and write until he was 13 years old. But thanks to his good reading skills, he was able to study at a basic gardening school. The ambitious Lysenko was then admitted to a prestigious secondary school specializing in agriculture. In 1921, he graduated from the Uman School of Horticulture, and in 1925 from the Kiev Agricultural Institute. In 22-25, T.D. Lysenko worked as a senior specialist in the selection of vegetable crops at the Belotserkovsk Experimental Station. In 25-29, he worked as the head of the legume breeding department at the experimental station in Ganya. In 29-34, he worked in Odessa as a senior specialist in the Department of Physiology of the All Union Selection and Genetics Institute. In short, a rapid career in agronomy and plant breeding, with tomatoes and sugar beet as something of a specialty. But it was during his work as head of the kitchen plants at the experimental station in the early 20s that Lysenko had made a success of his pea plantations, whose seeds had survived the winter to emerge under the warming rays of the spring sun as a green carpet of beautiful, plump peas. Lysenko had concluded that temperature was the decisive factor in plant development. Every farmer knew that crops sown in the autumn to settle in the soil during the winter yielded more abundantly than those planted in the spring. However, autumn sowing was also more likely to fail during the cold period. What if the winter rest was completely unnecessary? Lysenko reasoned. Perhaps the plants could be tricked by exposing the seeds to a period of cold and then sowing them in the spring when the weather was more favorable. Simple, but genius is how this boat floats. Colleagues regarded Lysenko as a passionate maverick, constantly stained by mud, soil, and sweat. Every morning he was the first one in the field to talk to his plants, which, according to Lysenko, told him what they wanted and needed. He lived for and with his plants, trusting his intuition and the language of the plants he knew how to speak. He rejected the sophisticated explanatory models of genetics, which in his opinion deviated plant breeding and the experimental station in directions of no practical significance. He was about to develop a new method that was better, cheaper, and faster than anything the professors could achieve. When the great Nikolai Vavilov heard about the experiments and sent an associate to investigate, Lysenko was flattered and excited by the opportunity to showcase himself and his plants to the elite at the headquarters in Leningrad. The report described Lysenko as hardworking, bold, and talented, but also uneducated and extremely egocentric. He had even spoken of himself as a future messiah of biological science. I guess it takes one to know one, right, Vavilov? Right, it's always better to be a, a martyr than a messiah, huh? What Vavilov came to observe was that which Lysenko would later call in his report of 1929, vernalization, which is the first great breakthrough of our protagonist, and one that echoes throughout the scientific corridors to this day. Let us thus take a break in the biography and explain what this was about. Of course, as with practically everything in the world of science, Lysenko cannot be said to have invented the method in its most rudimentary form. It had probably existed, just like Mendel's experiments, in some way or another since before antiquity. But it was Lysenko's interpretation of the phenomenon, his theoretical model to explain it, his insistent experimentation to make it count, and fundamentally his political insights on how to turn it into a peasant revolution, guided by a science which societies worst off could relate to, which set him apart. Vernalization involves treating seeds with moisture and cold temperatures during winter. This technique made it possible to accelerate the ripening and increase the yield of grains, potatoes, and other crops, as well as to sow varieties of spring wheat in more northern regions than before. Inducing or accelerating flowering also ensures that temperate zone plants will not flower until after winter, which means it is not only of great interest theoretically, but also effective in agricultural practice, since it ensures fructification while forestalling frost damage. It will soon, in our life, become even more important, since climate change does not only make winters colder or summer hotter, the seasons also become more unpredictable. For example, during the Great Dip of the Little Ice Age towards the end of the 1600 in Sweden, winter would sometimes suddenly disappear in January, causing dormant seeds to sprout and germinate too early. Whilst the middle of the summer would suddenly be struck by frost and plants would die before bearing fruit. During the 30s and 40s, Lysenko was one of the main references in textbooks of plant physiology, and the term vernalization, which derives from Lysenko, is still an extant scientific term and frequently appears in many prestigious journals. Though, of course, you would never be able to guess that from reading the articles in Nature Journal, for example, because it would just make everything too embarrassing, I guess. If they do mention it, these journals are suddenly very postmodern in their interpretation of who might have actually invented something before going on to, you know, nonetheless use the term which Trofim coined. From his study of vernalization, Lysenko built his famous theory of phasic development of plants, which he wrote about in a small book of 100 pages in 1928. This is his second great contribution. He investigated the effects on the development not only of low and high temperatures, but also various regimes of light, moisture, and other environmental factors on a number of cultivated plants. He discovered that the requirements of plants as to life conditions are not identical at different periods in their individual lives. At each phase of its development, a plant requires determinant conditions of life. Thus, autumn wheat and rye require fairly low temperatures in the first phase of their development and are indifferent to light. Once the phase of vernalization is terminated, the plant acquires new characteristics. Then begins the second phase of development, the luminous phase. At this phase, autumn wheat already requires higher temperatures and a fairly long light day. If these requirements are not met, the plant does not pass through the luminous phase and cannot move on to the next phase of development. Lysenko's theory of phasic development of plants has gradually evolved into a general framework for plant science, including not only plant physiology and development, but also genetics. We will eventually pay close attention to how the manipulation of aforementioned factors of development, light, temperature, moisture, etc., can be used to convert winter wheat to spring wheat, and vice versa, as the implications of this phenomenon shatters some of the major points of genetics against the Lamarckian maxim of the inheritance of acquired characteristics. But we will continue to leave this aside for now, since in this book, the influence of thermal factors on the duration of phases in the development of plants, the one I referred to earlier, knowledge of the time needed for cultivated plants of different varieties to go through the different stages of development, sprouting, vegetative growth, flowering, seed growth, ripening, etc., under varying climatic conditions, was primarily recognized by Lysenko as important not because of academic dispute, but for agricultural management. Much work on this topic was conducted in the Soviet Union, and even though a classic formulation of the concept of stages in development had been given by the German plant physiologist G. Klebs in 1918, Lysenko's ambition was to provide a theory that would make it easier to generalize the results. In the 1928 book, he gave a formula for the relationship between temperature and speed of development, N equals A divided by within brackets T minus B. Here N is the number of days the plant needs to go through a certain phase of development, B is the minimum temperature needed, A is the quantity of heat needed, measured in degree days, and T is the daily mean temperature. This provides a simple formalization of the well-known fact that biological processes run more quickly the higher the temperature. He also gave other formulas when this was not the case. My understanding is that Lysenko designed these formulas precisely because they are so simple. A great mass of farmers in all the corners of the Union would need nothing but simple maths, a calendar and a thermometer to help in the mapping and collection of agricultural data. Later critics have instead thought it to be revealing for the kind of scientist he was, that Lysenko in their mind believed that there were simple tests through which the truth of a theory could be established once and for all, and they deduce from this their own assessment that superstition in the ability of science to reach final knowledge is not uncommon among people with a poor training in the scientific method. Ipso facto, he was a naive and misguided idealist, a fanatic. This was not the attitude of his contemporaries. Even though the paper wasn't received with standing ovations at the first congress in Leningrad, which Vavilov had invited him to, Vavilov and some of his colleagues nonetheless reasoned that despite the lack of academic rigor, it was original and very exciting. He reminded them of Michurin, the gardener in Kozlov whom Nikolai Vavilov had visited and taken a liking to, even though Michurian genetics would later become a competitor to Mendel's genetics in both the West, the Soviet Union, and the Far East, including Japan, until this day. He also inspired the journalists and editors of Bednauta, which I think means poor, which, you know, as you might imagine, was the newspaper for poor peasants, which since its inception in 1918 and throughout much of the 20s had found it almost impossible to reach out to their readers in a way that would bridge the gap between agricultural science and, well, agriculture. We will soon have important reasons to return to this problem when we reach the topic of collectivization in the 30s. They saw in Lysenko and Michurin an ideal for the peasant scientist, who took up the fight against hunger by setting up small backyard laboratories, where they experimented with seeds, fertilizers, and different farming methods in an ultra-localized fashion. And when I say ideal, I really mean ideal. One journalist from Bednauta described Trofim's appearance in the frankest Russian way I've ever heard or read. Quote, "He looks like a toothache feels." The critics in Leningrad, the liberal intelligentsia, who were accustomed to measuring scientific merit by foreign titles, grants from Western charitable foundations, and laudable articles in the foreign press, many of whom now Lysenko, as he confided to a friend, viewed as enemies for their incapability of recognizing the needs of the peasants, seemed to him especially indifferent to one of the biggest problems of Soviet agriculture, which was that the wheat sown in the autumn did not always survive until spring. In the year 1927 to 1928, the harvests had been catastrophically bad, worse than for decades. In some areas of the granary of the Ukraine, up to 90% of the autumn wheat froze to death. And just to emphasize, this is before the collectivization had begun. We might even read it as a good reason to implement it. After all, NEP quarterly speculations on the international grain market, just like Midwestern dust bowls, might not have been the most long-term agroecological way of administration mankind had ever seen. Just saying, it might not have been. Finding a quick solution should have been the top priority. Never minding the footnote structure and citational style of his essay, Lysenko had come rushing in with proof that his cooling method worked. In the autumn of 1928, he had asked his father, Denis, to bury two sacks of autumn wheat under the snow and then sow them in the spring. The result in 1929 was seemingly astonishing. The harvest was three times larger than normal. A delegation from the Ministry of Agriculture was amazed to report. Now, not only Bednauta, but even Pravda had reason to cheer the agronomist Mr. Lysenko. Lysenko, who according to the newspapers had achieved a completely colossal breakthrough, whose enormous importance could not even be calculated. The way was now open for Soviet agriculture. This amazing discovery was guaranteed to speed up the construction of socialism. In Darwinian terminology, Trofim Lysenko had found his own niche in the socialist evolution. His unmatched natural curiosity had taken him from the backwaters of the Ukraine to the big hallways of big decision, all whilst the poor peasant himself seemed to just want to return to his plants and keep learning. But in 1929, when the newspaper Benauta launched a campaign to raise the level of knowledge in agriculture, an army of 23,000 farmers spontaneously joined to follow the way of Lysenko and show that they were not sub-illiterate morons.
Enda ska jag stå vid något hav med vågor som vältrar sig in. En dag då jag har gett mig av, en dag ska jag se solen brinna och jag står på främmande strand. En dag då jag står vid något hav som en svala.
To listen to the rest of this episode, please subscribe to the Patreon or on Spotify. If you subscribe, you will not only learn more about Lysenko and the days when genetic reductionism took over, you will also be given access to well-researched extended series that will take you on a long journey through the parapolitical history of cannabis, the murder of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme in the 80s, or how New Ageism, ufology, and the ancient aliens narrative came to be through the Stargate conspiracy, as well as other upcoming future originally researched projects that you will not find anywhere else. I live in a small house in a small Alp village with my partner and a young boy, tending a natural farm with an old man in his 70s. I wish to make this podcast show my full-time job whilst providing my local retired community and kindergarten with good, healthy food. It's very difficult for me to maintain regular office jobs as a diagnosed psychotic, so please consider supporting this project with a few dollars. Thank you very much, and hope to see you there soon.